Hello, everyone. This is Jeffrey Davis again, and we're back on the air on Radio Entrepreneurs. And if I can just take a moment of time to remind everybody, because I was being asked again yesterday, if you go to your smartphone and type in Radio Entrepreneurs, you can get the Radio Entrepreneurs app and listen to us 24/7, 7 days a week, or even as I did. I listened to it last month in Italy. My wife thought I was crazy. And you can also go to our website, radioentrepreneurs.com. And you can listen to any of our shows, our interviews for the 45 days. You can also go to our YouTube channel, Radio Entrepreneurs, and get any, you can get some samples of all of our interviews. And so many ways to listen to Radio Entrepreneurs, and those are just a few that I wanted to remind you about. Our next guest, someone I met last month, who I was very impressed with. I think you will be too. Sean Gilligan of Gesmer Undergrove. I hope I pronounced it right.
And he's a member.
Up the Grove, sorry. And he's a member of the firm and corporate finance and banking. He's going to talk to us today about technology and the law. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
So just as a brief introduction for those who don't know the firm, can you describe the firm to us?
Yeah. Gesmer Undergrove is a small boutique. We're located down in the financial district. We represent our primary clients, our high-tech clients, coming out of the lab, out of the garage, off the dining room table. We work with them at almost the embryonic stage up to the point where they either go public or get sold. And we have the opportunity to grow, but we've decided not to. We sort of enjoy working amongst ourselves. We enjoy this area. It can be tough in the beginning. I mean, sometimes you're carrying clients, but it can be very satisfying because you get to see sort of new technology coming to market, great success, a lot of entrepreneurs who frankly aren't in it for the money. They're in it for the development, for the product, for what they're doing, sort of for society. So that's neat as well.
So you're probably dealing with, I have also probably not as much as you have, a lot of founders who want to be the CEOs long term, and that's probably not in the clouds.
Exactly.
In the cards.
We run into that all the time, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got their
called founder dilemma, they call it.
The founder dilemma, the Peter Principle level.
Right.
Excellent. Yep.
And so you must get a lot of your clients from investors, VCs, Mass Challenge, places like that. Are you hanging around that area of the woods?
Absolutely. All of those, right? WeWork, right? WeWork is one of our clients and stuff like that. That's a great incubator now, a recent incubator. Association for Corporate Growth, that's another
right.
great feeder. A lot of accountants, a lot of the labs over at MIT.
Right.
I mean, we met Colin Angel over at the labs at MIT when he started iRobot and whatnot. And we represented iRobot, again, from the embryonic stage to the point where Ramba really sort of took off and effectively turned that company into a public company.
Right.
And that was a good 10 to 12 year run.
And that's interesting. So you're really, sometimes you do have a long, high-tech entrepreneurs don't always understand that it's a longer runway than it is.
Oh, absolutely. And it really depends on the marketplace, too. Like software companies have like a much faster growth rate and frankly a much shorter lifespan in the event, unless they sort of reinvent themselves or get sold to a much bigger competitor. Whereas like a technology company can last, it really could take some time. It takes a lot of back-breaking work to get through it. And they can have like a 10-year lifespan, 10 to 12-year lifespan.
You know, I always think in business that I sort of see it like a sports season, that, you know, December 31st is the end of the year, and what you did last year has no bearing on the year on the next year. Are you finding changes in the marketplace going into 2016?
The marketplace for us is always changing, both from the client perspective, but also from just the practice of law perspective. There's tremendous pressure on margins at a law firm, right? We're always looking ways to cut expenses, and that's one of the reasons why we like being a boutique, is because we can sort of watch and count our pencil stubs. We have fixed overhead like anybody else does, but we're able to go ahead and control that much easier than many of the big firms do. What we love about Boston, though, is there's just like this wealth of creativity that just sort of emerges from the ground, right? And there's a lot of money here as well to go ahead and support that. So you've got a lot of very bright people coming out of MIT and Harvard, Boston, BC, some of the schools out in the suburbs and whatnot, like Olin and whatnot. A lot of very creative talent. And with that, you put that together with human capital and then economic or money and whatnot, and things start to happen. Now, in the sort of the practice of law part of it, yes. Frankly, some practices just aren't as vibrant and are frankly going away. And a number of big firms are just shedding entire practice areas just because they don't you just can't keep them around anymore. So they're becoming boutiques and whatnot. So for instance, like bankruptcy, when I first started practicing law in 1987, bankruptcy was a vibrant practice up and down the ladder, right? From the big firms to this.
Bankruptcy is it has cycles, correct?
Absolutely. Right. Yep. But the stigma of going bankrupt has gone, right? So now companies are using bankruptcies. Occasionally, bankruptcy is a strategic alternative.
Speak to Donald Trump.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I just had to write a client of mine a note about that yesterday because he sent me a video about Donald Trump and the bankruptcies where someone was shooting Trump down for bankruptcies. And I said, it's within the law. It's a business strategy.
Yes. Yep.
And I said, and every entrepreneur has had failures. It's how you manage those failures.
And with any pile of ashes.
I'm not saying I'm a Trump fan, by the way. I'm not Tom Brady. I'm just saying it's a business strategy.
Oh, absolutely. And we see it. I mean, it's being used in the oil and gas industry. Right. Could some of these companies survive without bankruptcy? Absolutely. But they come up with a prepackaged bankruptcy. They clean off the balance sheet because they know that once oil starts to go back up, they want to be there with a very clean balance sheet. So particularly in the service end of the oil and gas industry.
Chicken or egg, were the laws designed on purpose to allow companies to do that, or have companies figured out the law so that they do that?
The latter. With the talent that has been attracted into the bankruptcy world and whatnot, you've got some very creative people.
Okay. I'm glad I asked you that question because you've just added to my own knowledge base because I never knew which way it was.
Yeah, no, it was designed, you know, sort of the fresh start. That's the whole concept in bankruptcy, right. Both at the corporate and the individual level and whatnot. And corporations, again, back in the late 80s when I first started doing that, it actually worked. You could take a company with, call it $10 million in annual revenue. They were a small manufacturer located in whatever city, you know, Hartford, Boston, whatever. And you could go through bankruptcy and clean off the balance sheet and work out an agreement. Nowadays, impossible, right? It's just the marketplace is too compressed. The margins are too tight. You just can't do that anymore. Bankruptcy is much used much more for the bigger companies and whatnot. But again, with all that creative talent there, they have figured out how to go ahead and make this work for everyone. Naturally, someone gets the short end of the stick. It's primarily the unsecured creditors, the bondholders, and the equity security holders.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot of small business owners who don't like Donald Trump who have been taken down
absolutely.
By his projects.
Absolutely.
That I know about as well. So there is the other side of it. There were victims to his process. You know, the ends justify the means, I guess, in his world. But back to my question, because you actually took it not where I thought you were, but I liked where you took it. I was really wondering, and I know Boston's a good money market. Has the flow of money changed in 2016 from the end of 2015? Are people more cautious that you're finding, or are the standards changing for due diligence around money?
The short answer is no. There's still a lot of equity capital, and there's still a lot of debt capital. Everyone has their standards, but we have not seen anybody pull back and just say, well, you know, we've got to husband our resources. We're just not going to make that investment. We're going to figure out where this economy is going, which, in my opinion, is part of the beauty of the entrepreneurial market. And that is that capital is always there waiting for the next opportunity to invest. It's only in the dramatic events like 2008, 2009, or 2000, 2001 with the internet bubble collapse and whatnot. Does that entire community just sort of pull back? And frankly, I think it's because investors aren't giving the money to the various funds to invest on their behalf.
Well, that's an encouraging message I think you're giving me. So that's good for my clients, which I'm glad about. Do you think that if there is a downturn in the economy, it's going to change Boston's high-tech atmosphere at all?
Yes and no. You know, like with any downturn in the next recession, Boston will always be affected, right? It's a money center. It's going to be affected. But on the high tech side, no, I don't think so at all. I think that money, because if I had to predict the next recession and whatnot, you know, we overgrow.
You can say anything you want here because, you know, you know, there's no right or wrong.
It's just you know, there will be a contraction. It's going to be more of an equity contraction, frankly. Again, because I just see that the demand for the type of product, for the goods and services that Boston creates, continues to rise. The biotech industry is huge in Boston. That, I think, is almost immune. There's certainly a slight variation on the economic cycle for high tech. I mean, those investment cycles are so long term. And then sort of the feeders that come up, the sort of the one device or one medicine, biotech firms and stuff like that, they're not going to stop. They're not going to slow down. Their funding sources know that, right?
That's sort of what I believe because, you know, when I first started working in Boston, it was 1981, you know, I saw downturns, but I think the economy has a stronger foundation today than it did back then with the upswings and the downswings. It's more diversified. It's more education-based. I think the funding sources are stronger. I think there is a better foundation to this economy. I tell people it's a model economy.
Yes.
No economy is perfect, but it is a model economy.
It is a model economy.
Right. And it is an economy that other states and other cities do look at as well, as to look at what they need to do in this century. So I like what you're saying. Now, you also do work in family-owned business.
Yes.
That's a real switch from technology.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But some of our technology clients become family-owned business clients.
Right. Well, eventually, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, again, small, closely held companies and whatnot. And when I say small, you know, annual revenues of anywhere between, call it $5 million at the low end, all the way up to your $50, $60 million at the high end and whatnot. And, you know, the family dynamic is, I love it because it forces you to be, one, a diplomat, two, creative, but three, sort of passively assertive to get things done. And the larger the family, the more issues. And, you know, I come from a large family, and my ancestors, some of my grandparents and great-grandparents owned real estate in New York City. And I've gone through the exact same ringer as sort of the client. And it's, frankly, sometimes it's just not fun.
No, it's not. But, you know, I find, I used to do consulting at Sun Microsystems many, many years ago. And somebody stopped me in the halls once and said to me, most companies work in a calendar year, and at Sun we work in dog years. So we do things, you know, but everybody does in 1 year. We do 7 years worth of change. And technology companies that are family owned, all technology companies are working at a different pace, I find. The market's working faster, let's say, like in the food industry or something.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but I think the dynamic of family culture in a technology business is tough. So when I see second generation family members in a technology business, I get more nervous than in other industries that I see. Do they have the skills to move at that pace?
I couldn't agree more. You're right, because normally there's a matriarch or a patriarch,
right,
that created or founded the company, either individually or with a partner and whatnot. And you're right, by the time the second generation has come along, they either don't like their parents because arguably they don't see their mother or father, and thus haven't learned anything at what I call the dining room table, the education at the dining room table, or they think it's neat and they think they can get into it, but they don't have that magic, that sort of the magic touch that their mother or father had creating the company and growing it to the point.
It's like being a chef, I find.
Yeah.
You know, great chefs are great entrepreneurs.
Yes, absolutely.
And they have that special touch in the kitchen when they're making the bouillabaisse.
Yeah.
And just because dad or mom could make that special bouillabaisse doesn't mean you can make that special bouillabaisse, even if you've written down the recipe.
Yep. Yeah, no, exactly. And the other thing that I've noticed about tech companies is you're growing so fast. You know, there's a lot of money, both capital coming in and also profits building up and whatnot, that if you start bringing in family members as employees and whatnot, it upsets the balance within the corporation, which for a dynamic, fast-growing company could be death.
Right.
You know, like your good employees are not going to hang around because they're going to look at this and just say, okay, so-and-so who didn't go to a great school, doesn't really understand engineering, all of a sudden has this nice vice presidency. You know, either that should be mine or I've got to jump over him or he or she is not contributing. And then you're going to lose talent. And if you start losing talent, it's over. It's just because, again, it's this constant growth.
It's all about talent, but you do need some turnover.
Oh, absolutely.
People hold on to the wrong people for too long.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right. It's all about the people. Sean, I didn't even finish all my questions that I had prepared for you. Great talking to you. I hope you come back again and we'll talk some more. Can you tell us how people can find you if they want to talk to you about these different issues?
Yeah. Now, I'm a partner at Gesmer Updegrove. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. Gesmer Updegrove is on LinkedIn and Twitter. My email address is Sean, S-E-A-N, .Gilligan, G-I-L-L-I-G-A-N, at Gesmer, G-E-S-M-E-R, .com. That's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me is via email and stuff. But again, I'm on LinkedIn, Sean Gilligan, and on Twitter through the Gesmer, the at Gesmer.
I'll actually give another reason for people to call you, and I'll show you how my brain works. You're across the street from one of my favorite sushi places.
Oh, yeah. No. Sakabara is great. It's absolutely great. It's packed. You've got to go to lunch there. You've got to arrive at like 11:30 to get a table.
I like the spicy scallop maki. Okay. I'm there. anytime you want. Well, again, my name is Jeffrey Davis. I've been speaking with Sean Gilligan. Met Sean last month in a panel, and as far as I was concerned, he stood out alone on that panel for his talents. But I was the only, there was one accountant and myself, and then everybody else on the panel was an attorney.
That's right.
But you stood tall amongst attorneys, physically and mentally. So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on, well, of course, Radio Entrepreneurs.